settle in with your brunch or your lunch or your midnight snack, whatever you're up to now, and listen in. Today we're going to talk about food. First, let me give you some numbers, some bad news. In 2008, more than 50% of all U.S. harvested cropland grew only two crops, corn and soybeans. And more than 40% of the food calories consumed worldwide came from just three crops, wheat, corn, and rice. 30% of Detroit residents receive food stamps, but 92% of Detroit's food stamp retailers offer few or no fresh fruit or vegetables. Agriculture is the leading source of pollution in nearly 50% of river miles and over 40% of lake acres that are quality impaired. Our food system, this is wild, consumes 10.3 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1.4 calories of food energy. And the average plate of food eaten in our homes or restaurants travels 1,500 miles from where the food is grown. But there's also some good news. There are now 8,000 farm-to-school programs across the U.S. 8 years ago, there were only four. There are now 6,000 farmers' markets in the U.S., and that's three times as many as in 1995. And 330 hospitals in the U.S. and Canada have pledged to purchase food that is grown according to fair food principles. Now, in recent years, a number of books and films have documented the dangers of our current food system, and we featured a number of those on Free Forum. But advice on what to do about it largely begins and ends with the admonitions to eat local or eat organic. This advice is not helpful if you live in an area where you can buy ketchup, but not tomatoes. Just as you can't alter the course of climate change by simply switching to efficient light bulbs, today's guests believe you can't fix the broken food system by simply growing a backyard garden. It requires redesigning that food system. My first guest, Oren Hesterman, has a new book, Fair Food, A Guide to Changing Not Only What We Eat, but How Our Food is Grown, Packaged, Delivered, Marketed, and Sold. Fair Food offers questions to ask at farmers markets, tools for starting buy fresh, buy local campaigns, advice for forming buyers clubs that purchase food directly from farmers and fishermen, and guidance about the legislation to support at the local, state, and federal levels. Hesterman opens the book talking about Detroit, Michigan, an unlikely beacon of hope in the fight for fair food. My second guest will be Lila Connors. She's with Tree Media in Santa Monica and the producer of Urban Roots, a new documentary that tells the story of the food revolution taking place in Detroit, leading their sustainable food systems programs. And before that, he researched and taught in the Crop and Soil Sciences Department at Michigan State University in East Lansing. And for more than 15 years, he co-led the Integrated Farming Systems and Food and Safety Programs for the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, during which time that foundation seeded the local food systems movement with over $200 million. Fair Food is his first book. Oren Hesterman.
Thank you, Terrence. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I like to use a format when it fits that I call, it's broke, let's fix it. Okay? So in this case, what's broken is the U.S. food system. And I'm going to ask you to answer, although I may sprinkle in others, I'm going to ask you to answer four big questions. The first is, how is it broken? What is the evidence? The second will be, how did it get broken? What's the history, the causes, the culprits? Third, what will it look like when we fix it? The vision and the goals. And fourth, how do we fix it? What are the solutions? How do people get involved? Okay?
Great. All topics that I wrote about in the book.
Exactly. No, I use this when it works. And when I looked at your book and when I saw you speak last night, it was clear that this one was just made for this. Now, first, I do like to get listeners to get a feel for the people that I'm interviewing behind the work and the ideas. So I'm going to ask you two questions. The first one is briefly about your path. I just went through, you know, the bio, but in terms of your telling it, maybe a little more mentors or turning points or moments of decision, your path to the work that you're doing today and the work we're talking about.
Yeah, certainly. My path leads me back to Santa Cruz, California in the early 70s, where I was a student at University of California there and was attracted to what only later I realized was the first student organic farm project in the country.
Wow.
And ended up spending a couple of years there learning how to farm. And really, you know, growing vegetables, growing organic fruit, and just that's where I both fell in love with this issue and realized this was going to be my life's purpose and passion. From there, I spent about 8 years in the alfalfa sprout business in Northern California, starting from literally delivering sprouts on the back of a bicycle to a small business employing 20 people, growing 9 tons of sprouts a month, delivering them all over the Western United States, the first alfalfa sprouts in the Safeway chain back in the 70s. So learned a lot about innovation and business in the food system. But I was always really intrigued by the science. So back to school with degrees at UC Davis, our great agricultural institution here in California, and then on for a doctorate in agronomy and plant genetics at University of Minnesota, which led me to my first career in academia. So all the way along, I've been interested in this issue, how we are going to feed ourselves on this planet in a way that keeps the environment in a healthy shape for future generations and gets us the healthy food we need. But a real turning point for me was when I was 36 years old, and I found myself lying in a hospital bed with such a severe case of ulcerative colitis, which I've been dealing with my whole adult life, that my digestive system had shut down. The doc comes in and says, you know, if it doesn't cool down, this inflammation doesn't cool down by the end of the week, their only option is surgery, and I'm going to live the rest of my life without a colon. You know, they're pumping me full of prednisone to try to cool the inflammation down. By the time, a couple days go by, the doc says, we got to see if you can eat something. So what comes in on the tray? Roast beef, a pile of mashed potatoes, and some big-ass piece of cake. And I say to myself, whoa, this is not the food that I need to eat to get my colon healthy again. So I politely returned the food and called up a friend of mine and asked her if she'd come save my life this week and bring me some brown rice, tofu, and steamed greens. Well, fortunately, I got better, and I'm very healthy right now.
I've had Dr. Andy Weil on the program. One of the things that he said at that point, a few years ago, may not be true now, but it was that in all the time of medical school, residency, training, and so on, some doctors had no time with nutrition, and most had maybe one course.
Well, I was told by the doctors at that time when I started trying to figure out how I'm going to heal myself from this disease, by gastroenterologists, sorry, we have no evidence that there's any connection between what you eat and the health of your colon. And I said, well, that may be your perspective from a medical researcher, but my perspective from the guy who's got this disease, I've got to figure out how to feed myself well. Fortunately, I had the knowledge and the access to the food I needed. But while I was lying in that hospital bed for that week, I thought about all the people who don't have the education or knowledge about how to feed themselves healthy food, the food they need for themselves and their kids, or if they do have the knowledge, they simply don't have the access.
You know, I want to share very briefly, just because it's a sign of some progress. I have, similarly, I planted my first organic acre in 1971. So I came, you know, did the whole thing, compost, ladybugs, everything. Sold the crops by the side of the road to people going, this was in Connecticut on the post road there. So I go way back with this, but I also have colon issues. I went to a gastroenterologist this year. He had three recommendations. One, probiotics, try that. If that doesn't work, go off dairy. And if that doesn't work, go off gluten. So we've seen some progress.
I say hallelujah.
Yes.
You found yourself a progressive gastroenterologist, and let's hope that that is a sign of progress in the field.
And just the probiotics made a significant difference, and so I haven't had to go off the dairy or the gluten yet. If you hadn't gone down this path, what else do you think you might have done?
You know, I really thought when I was going to graduate school, I really thought that I might go back into agribusiness. I mean, I've always known that my purpose is to help us figure out how we're going to shift our food system, but I thought I might be doing that from inside the belly of the beast, so to say. And with my business background in the alfalfa sprout business, a business administration minor along with my PhD, I really thought that I might be heading to industry. But, you know, I got so captured by the research and the science that when I had an opportunity to spend about a dozen years at one of our great land-grant universities doing research on these topics, I couldn't pass it up.
And then talk to us a little bit about what you did at Kellogg.
So Kellogg Foundation was a fabulous experience where I...
And obviously for people who it might occur to you, this is a foundation that is built on the wealth of the Kellogg family, which was
absolutely the
cereal industry.
Mr. Kellogg, who started and made his fortune selling cornflakes and other breakfast cereal, endowed a foundation back in 1930 with almost all of his personal wealth. That foundation, the money that he put in back in 1930 has now grown, and Kellogg is now about the fifth largest philanthropic foundation in the United States now.
That's massive.
They've always had some interest in agriculture issues, but not until the early 90s did they really start focusing on sustainability as an important issue. And I was just fortunate enough to be there at that moment, first on a sabbatical leave from Michigan State, and then actually as a full-time employee when I left Michigan State to go to Kellogg. I really had the opportunity to help Kellogg create their funding program in sustainable food and agriculture, and then help lead that program for a number of years. And what that means at a foundation is that I had the opportunity to read hundreds of proposals from organizations all over the country wanting to start doing work in sustainable agriculture and local food systems, and then making decisions about where to place the funding. And in hindsight, we hoped we were seeding a movement, but you never quite know when you're in the middle of doing it. But in hindsight, you know, there are very few organizations that you find today working in the local and sustainable food system movement in the United States that don't have some trace of Kellogg funding or Kellogg networking in their DNA.
Yeah, and I know Kellogg also is one of the foundations that really cares about leadership development.
Absolutely.
You know, we talk a lot about nonprofits and foundations here because we're looking for solutions. And one of the pitfalls of foundations is that very often they will fund only programs. And the nonprofit can have young people that need to develop and have no resources to do that because all their money is geared specifically to a program. And I know Kellogg.
Yeah, I love it. When you walk into the lobby of the Kellogg Foundation, a big quote from Mr. Kellogg, "I will invest my money in people."
There you go. Well, so, okay. They're still doing it.
Absolutely.
And what led you to leave and do what you're doing now?
So I had an opportunity to leave the Kellogg Foundation and start a new foundation, the Fair Food Foundation, which now is a public charity nonprofit that I run. And it was, it was time for me, you know, after 15 years in the foundation world, which is a wonderful place to be supporting others to do important work. It was time for me to step out and start doing some of the work on the ground and really taking advantage or stepping up to the opportunity of leadership in this field that is so needed and necessary right now.
That's the voice of Orrin Hesterman. We're talking about his work for Fair Food, and a lot of it contained in his very solutions-oriented, activism-oriented book, Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. Okay, let's go to those four big questions. Briefly, because this is the part that I think people know the most about already, is how is our food system broken? What's the evidence?
Well, at the beginning of the show, Terrence, you really helped our listeners understand that with some of the statistics you rattled off. But, you know, whether we look at environmental issues like a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico the size of the state of Massachusetts now, fed by agricultural runoff of fertilizers and pesticides all up and down the Mississippi watershed, whether we look at farm worker issues or food worker issues, the invisible workforce, those people who are working to bring us our food each day, the conditions under which they work or live, whether we look at the spiraling rates of obesity and diet-related illness happening in this country, which is going to bankrupt us if we don't do something about it, rather than seeing these all as problems to be solved each individually, I view these as symptoms of a food system that is broken and out of control, and that I don't believe we will be able to solve these problems one by one. What it's going to take is a redesign of our food system. We have to redesign our food system based on different kinds of principles. So rather than creating all these attendant problems environmentally, socially, health-wise, we actually have a system that can dissolve those problems.
So let me just go back to the question, which was the evidence. The evidence is in the pollution. It's in the quality of the food that too many of our people have access to. It's in the inequity of the way food is available and distributed. It's in the obesity. It's in the diabetes. It's in the schools.
It's in the school. It's in the fact that it's so difficult for people now to the barriers to entry to a farming occupation are so high now that we know the average age of farmers in this country is close to 60 years old.
Right.
The barrier to entry is high. The symptom of the lack of economic viability in our rural communities, and many of our rural communities withering away.
And so a piece of that is the concentration. It's not quite as concentrated in crops as it is in animals. Animals were basically down to four.
80% of all of our beef slaughtered and packed by four companies.
Yeah.
But even in, you look at food retail, 47% of all food retail in the United States controlled by just four companies.
And that's supermarkets, not producers, right?
Correct.
But then we also know about the Archer Daniels Midland, the Cargills, the ConAgras, that what everyone who's been looking at this issue at all over the last few years knows, what we call is, on the meat side, factory farms, on the crop side, monoculture. Basically, it's using a factory model for agriculture.
Right, right. I say these are all symptoms of a food system that's out of balance and needs to be brought back in balance.
And it's interesting, yes, that you shift it from, it isn't just we got to take care of this here and that there, but you see it as a system. Does some of that come from the fact that you come from agriculture?
You know, I think so. I'm an agronomist. That's my training. And I call agronomists thus kind of the ecologists of agriculture. We have to look at things as a system. You know, we're working, we're the scientists who are working with farmers. I had the opportunity over about a dozen year period to work with many farmers across the state of Michigan, helping them see how to create systems that were going to be more environmentally and economically viable. You have to look at things as a system. And when you're a farmer, you have to look at this as a system.
That when you take that view into academia, you take that view into the foundation world, you take that view into activism, you see that it's a whole system we've got to change.
Right.
Okay. How did the American food system get broken? What's a bit of the history? And here, again, we're going to focus as much as we can on the redesign and the solutions. But was there ever a golden age?
Well, I suppose golden age all depends on where you're sitting at a particular period of time. I believe that our food system that we have in place right now is the natural outcome of decades of public policy that have driven it in a certain direction. Now, when our current agricultural policies or those like them were first created back in the 1930s on the heels of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl years, they made a lot of sense. They were policies to help maintain economic viability of farmers in our rural communities. They were also meant to create a food system where calories and nutrition could get to masses of people at low cost. It was a time when we were rapidly urbanizing in this country. It demanded, you know, our country demanded a food system that was highly efficient and that could deliver food at low cost. And we put together policies in terms of subsidies, in terms of certain kinds of support for farmers to do that. We put policies in place that would support certain types of research and innovation, and that all pretty much made sense then. The problem we have is that the policies we have in place, even up till today, are much like those policies we put into place over 70 years ago.
And let me say, first of all, I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Orrin Hesterman. We're talking about Fair Food. He is the president and CEO of Fair Food Network and the author of Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. Websites where you can learn more, fairfoodnetwork.org, fairfoodbook.org. If you go back to Thomas Jefferson, this idea of us as an agrarian nation, the resourcefulness and independence of our agricultural sector, of our farmers, of our rural folk, my guess is that when those policies began to shift coming out of the 30s, one of the things they did was they tried to shield farmers from the vicissitudes of weather.
And the volatility of markets.
Exactly.
Both.
Which sort of play together, mm-hmm. but it was, now once you do that, then I can see where other folks begin to look at agriculture as a business.
Also, what happens is, you know, anytime you put policies in place that create a resource flow, a flow of dollars, you are automatically building a constituency and a stakeholder group that now is going to defend that flow. And that has happened up until today. We have very strong, what are called commodity organizations, organizations that have made sure over the years that we have direct payments for corn farmers, for soybean farmers, for rice farmers, for cotton farmers. these are very effective lobbying organizations.
And one of the things I think when the last farm bill, which the farm bill may be something new to most people, but the farm bill is where many of our agriculture policies get decided and redecided. And it doesn't happen every year. It usually happens every 4 or 5 years.
It's reauthorized every 5 years or
okay.
so.
Okay. And the last one, 2008
mm-hmm.
Was the first time I think I saw people actually saying, wait a minute, let's pay some attention to this. My experience growing up has been that the farm bill is something which if you're from Iowa or you're from Kansas or Nebraska or, you know, California, and it's your constituents' issue, you care about it. And what happened, I believe, most of the time over the years is other senators, other congressmen didn't much care about it. So it became something that always passed the way those folks wanted because they kind of swapped and horse traded. I'll back your highway bill. I'll back your this that helps you because agriculture doesn't really matter to you. 2008 was the first time I saw a lot of political awareness that the farm bill matters to everybody.
You know, a couple things have happened. One is that in the environmental movement, those concerned with environment and conservation have now realized that the farm bill and agriculture policy is probably the most important policy area for environmental issues and for conservation and stewardship of the environment. So back starting in the 90s, we had environmental or large environmental advocacy groups start playing a role in farm bill policy. But another very significant group that has played an increasing role are legislators from urban areas, because when we look at the so-called farm bill, the omnibus piece of legislation that really directs those resource flows in our food system, close to 75% of the money flowing through U.S. Department of Agriculture is for what's now called supplemental nutrition assistance, used to be called food stamps.
How much again?
75 cents.
75 cents of each dollar.
Every dollar.
Okay.
And
so
the farm bill
is massive, right?
Huge. Right now, that just for food stamps alone, it's about a $75 billion a year resource flow.
So about $100 billion resource flow each year.
Yes.
75% of which goes to food stamps. And also, I would imagine the other thing that's happened in those urban areas is the obesity and the diabetes have finally gone off the charts and people have begin to look a little bit upstream for root causes.
Well, a newer constituency group paying attention to the farm bill now are public health and healthcare organizations, which I think is really good news that we're starting to see. The farm bill is not only for farmers. It's not only for rural people. It guides the direction of our entire food system. So anybody who cares about a food system that's going to function and be healthy for our environment, for our own personal and public health, for the health of our economy, you got to focus on the farm bill. You can't leave it to anybody else.
Again, to get back to that question, the history and the causes, what you're saying is that the food system in the U.S. today is greatly a result of certain policies that were put in place 60, 70 years ago and that have solidified, grown, et cetera, but not been altered. And our nation is a very different nation.
Right. They have not been altered in a transformational way. The challenge is the context that we're living in today is so different than it was back in the 30s. And, you know, the good news is we can see that it was policy that drove us in the direction we're in now. It means you want to change your direction, change the policies, and that's a start.
And one of the things you say, and I mentioned it in the introduction, that a lot of the focus over the last few years, this exciting focus and this needed focus, whether it's Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation, the work of Michael Pollan, Food Inc., et cetera, we are finally exposing to people who think that food grows on grocery store shelves to the actual workings of our food system. But what you set out to do in your work and in this book is actually change that system as a system.
Right. That we have some great authors, journalists, and movie makers who have really helped us focus on what the problems, challenges, issues are. I say it's now time to look for solutions. It's now time to take the next step because we know what a fair food system looks like, and we actually know the steps we need to take to create that, and it's time to get to work. We don't have any time to waste.
Okay. Orrin Hesterman, author of A Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. You said we know what a fair food system looks like. tell us what that is. This is that third question. What is the vision of a system that actually works for all?
So I think of it in a couple of different ways, Terrence. When I think about fair food, I think about food that is healthy, good for our bodies, green, grown in an environmentally friendly way. Fair means nobody's getting exploited in that system from the time the seed's planted till the time we eat our food. Everybody's getting a share of the economic benefit of that system. And the fourth attribute would be affordable. Everybody has access. Healthy, green, fair, and affordable is a fair food system. And in the book, I lay out the principles of a fair food system. I say a fair food system should be based on principles like equity, diversity, ecological integrity, and economic viability.
Speak a little more about each.
So equity means that everybody needs to have access to the healthy food they need to live a healthy life. Workers need access to good jobs and healthy working conditions in our food system. And those small and mid-sized farmers need access to the land, water, and capital they need to be in business. That we need to create a food system where more people are getting access to what they need. That's equity. Diversity is a really important one. You know, I again, come from the perspective of an agronomist and an ecologist, and we know that any system is more resilient and stronger if it is diverse. The more diversity, the better. We know that biologically. Well, we also know that economic systems need to be diverse. Ownership structures need to be diverse. And the more diversity, the more social diversity we bring into a system, the stronger it is. So rather than having policies in place that encourage monoculture, encourage just a few crops to be grown or so many livestock being concentrated, we need policies in place that create more diversity on our landscape, in our agricultural system. It will be a healthier system overall.
A big reason why these policies have solidified and grown over the years is that once, as you said, once you have a constituency who is very wealthy and who the number one priority is to keep that money flowing to them and perpetuate the system that they depend on, that in our American system, especially with things like Citizens United, gives those powerful wealthy interests an enormous advantage.
Absolutely. So what it's going to take is a lot of engaged citizenry who understand that this farm bill, changing agriculture and food policy, is something they need to get engaged with. So if you're a listener in an urban area and you care about the viability of small and mid-sized farming in your area, and you care about the health of the food that's coming at you, and you care about making sure that people in low-income areas of your city have access to healthier food, engage with the farm bill. That's the place where the policies get made. And in my book, which I encourage you to read, I have actual ways to do that. I have a resource section that you don't have to do it alone. There are organizations, effective organizations, working on these issues that would love your time, your energy, and your money to help them succeed.
Very good. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Orrin Hesterman, president and CEO of Fair Food Network and author of Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. You can learn more at fairfoodnetwork.org or fairfoodbook.org. So that vision, equity, diversity,
ecological integrity.
Speak about that.
So ecological integrity means that we are creating a system of production and distribution that is actually helping steward our natural resources for the future, our environment for the future. So reducing our chemical load on the environment, reducing the amount of transportation we're putting into our food system. There are all kinds of ways for us to reduce our environmental footprint of agriculture, and we need to be doing that. So that's ecological integrity.
You know, you're looking at it from the food, the nutrition standpoint, but at a time of peak oil and a time of climate change, all of that you were just speaking about is critical, even if it wasn't creating obesity and diabetes
right.
And great inequity.
That's why I keep saying, let's look at this as a system and figure out what we need to put in place to redesign it so that we are prepared for these issues coming at us. We know that fuel is going to become more expensive, but we know that we can create a food system where we don't need to transport our food 1,500 miles to get to our plate. We can do it better. the more diverse we create our food system in terms of the number of crops, the livestock and crop integration, the more resilient we're going to create a system in terms of buffer capacity against the kind of climate disruptions that are likely to come.
And is there one more piece to your one
economic more viability?
Of course.
So economic viability, because, you know, after all, the food system is an economic system. It's a market-based system. This is not about environmental sustainability and no economic viability. We can't do this. This is about both at the same time. That, in fact, if you reduce the amount you're transporting food, you're saving money. If you reduce the amount of external chemicals you're purchasing for an agricultural system, you're saving money. So we can create,
and if you switch to some of those practices that actually keep your soil healthy and alive and vibrant through diversity and so on, you're actually, in the long run, going to save and make more money.
Right. Let me give you an example. A great example, you know, the largest food distribution company in the country to restaurants and cafeterias, Sysco. A few years ago, and I write about this in my book, a few years ago, they implemented a program called Advanced Integrated Pest Management, or IPM. And what that means is, rather than using chemical control on pests right away, you carefully monitor what's going on, and chemicals are your last resort, not your first, in making sure that you're taking care of pests in the field. Well, they implemented a set of standards, and every one of the farmers and processors who are bringing food to the Sysco company now has to perform under that set of standards. They now have 900,000 acres of production of fruits and vegetables around the country under these advanced integrated pest management strategies now. They have saved millions of pounds of pesticides. They've avoided using millions of pounds of pesticides. They have avoided using millions of tons of synthetic fertilizer because of these practices. It's a great example of focusing on ecological integrity that also brings greater economic viability.
How did that happen, Orrin Hesterman? A few weeks ago, I interviewed Ed Humes, who's written a book called A Force of Nature, which is why Walmart has gone to many sustainable practices. And it's not because an angel told them to. It's because they tried a few things. And when you get rid of wasted space, wasted packaging, wasted fuel, wasted all these things, you make money. What do you have the conversion story at Sysco?
Well, you know, we talked earlier about the importance of leadership. So I've gotten to know Rick Schneiders, who just last year retired as the CEO of Sysco after 10 years. And early on, you know, he said to himself, we are a company that has a huge environmental footprint. We should be doing something about this. It's our responsibility. And he got together with a few of the younger folks who understood this at Sysco, and they started with one crop, with asparagus, created a system where they could really reduce the chemical load on that crop, and started spreading it out to others. And he hooked up with the IPM Institute, a nonprofit organization, to help them create the standards. When I asked Rick, why did you do this? He said, well, number one, it's the right thing to do. Number two, we believe that the future that's coming at us is one where not only are these chemicals going to be more expensive, but we have to protect our environment, or we won't be in business in the future. So he understands that a long-term business strategy for the health of their business is to implement sustainability now.
And what's interesting is, as with Walmart, it sounds like they tried a pilot project.
Right.
And I'm sure against the grumblings of a lot of the entrenched folks, you know, in the company, and then they find out it saves them money. And then instead of going, you know, do we have to do this again, they start looking for where else can this happen.
Right. And now they're very proud of this program. And in fact, they are, what they're now looking at is that they believe that they can shift a lot of their procurement to more local sources.
Excellent.
And because, you know, after all, they say, you know, we're not really a food company, we're a logistics company.
That's right.
And why don't we use the logistics expertise we have to start procuring more locally? So cut some of those 1,500 miles off of the food. We're going to save environmentally, we're going to save economically. It's better all the way around. It's a win-win.
Okay, so let's go to the final question then, which is, what are the solutions? And what I'd love you to do is frame it, as you do in the book, in terms of a listener or a reader of your book who gets the urge to do something but doesn't know what to do. And one thing I would like you to talk about even is some of the organizations active in Southern California and in New York City. And then Lila will talk more about Detroit.
Great. So what I say is the single most important action to take is to make the shift from conscious consumer to engaged citizen.
Okay. In other words, and I you made this point very clearly when I saw you speak, if all you've done so far is become a conscious consumer, you're helping yourself, you're helping your family, and you're helping turn the tide, turn the aircraft carrier around, but it's not enough.
Right. It's not enough. I don't believe that by individuals so-called voting with their fork is going to be enough.
Because remember, as we said before, there are huge constituencies who have a vested interest and millions, if not billions of dollars to put against the change you're making at your table.
Right. So what I say is start where you live, work, play, or worship. Every institution that you're involved with and that we are all involved with uses money to buy food and is involved in the food system. So if you're a parent with children in schools right now, in the public schools, get involved with other parents to see what you can do to help bring more local and sustainably grown food into the food meals in your cafeteria. And there are specific ways to do this. And one great organization that got its start in Southern California is the Farm to School Network. Got its start right here at Occidental College. But they are all over the country now. The resource, the contact information is in my book. How you get in touch with Farm to School Network to know how you can connect with other parents and school food administrators in your area. If you're involved with healthcare, our healthcare institutions are a place where we can really make strides. I think of right here in California, Kaiser Permanente and the leadership they've taken to bring farmers markets to 38 of their hospital settings.
Wow.
And now 10% of all of the food that is sourced for inpatient meals and their cafeterias and catering service at Kaiser Permanente in California are sourced locally and sustainably. And there are other hospitals now getting on board. 350 hospitals around the country have signed the Healthy Food and Healthcare Pledge. If you're a college or university student, the Real Food Challenge is an organization that started on the East Coast, very active in both California and New York now. And you can find, again, contact information either in my book or on our website at fairfoodnetwork.org. We now have a channel called the Fair Food List. And on that list are all the organizations that are starting to work in this area. You can find that. The Real Food Challenge is a set of college and university students working to shift 20% of all food purchasing at university and college cafeterias by the year 2020. That equals $1 billion worth of food purchasing. So start with whatever institution you're engaged with. That's a place to expand beyond your own kitchen.
Okay, and then another piece is policy.
Absolutely. We talked about that already, but you know, the Farm Bill is important. If you have any connections or want to create connections with either organizations working on Farm Bill policy, or if you have connections with your elected representatives, let them know. It doesn't matter if you're from a rural area. Let your Congress people and senators know that you care about the Farm Bill, you want them to care about the Farm Bill, and you want them to be pushing for a food policy and agricultural policy that's more environmentally friendly, that is focused on helping everybody get access to the healthy food they need, especially in our inner city communities. But we don't have to just wait and rely on federal policy. There are things you can do closer to home. I think about policies to make sure our prime farmland is protected for future generations. It's a real issue in places that are more rapidly developing. And there are great examples around the country, some right here in Southern California, land conservancies that are making sure that we are protecting farmland close to our urban areas so that in the future we have the precious soil that we need to grow our food.
Okay, so you made this shift, you said 3 years ago, to the Fair Food Network?
Yes, and this, yes.
Mm-hmm. And your sense of, this is kind of the last question, Oren, your sense of this moment, the strides we're making, whether there is momentum and so on. And I have to say, in the fact that if you look around the country, obviously, and you look at politics these days, we're still in a recession. Wall Street has gotten out of it, but most of us are not. What's your sense of how we're doing?
You know, I've been at this work, Terrence, for almost 40 years now. I truly believe we stand at an historical moment right now. We're at a moment where we are getting leadership on this issue from the White House, whether it's the First Lady's Organic Garden or her Let's Move initiative. we're at a moment where federal funds are going into farm-to-school programs all over the country. Never happened before. We're at a moment where we see the commercial interests, whether it's Cisco or whether it's the growth of Whole Foods or whether it's the growth of farmers markets, as you talked about at the beginning of the show, you know, tripling since the mid-90s. We are seeing all kinds of commercial interests jump on board, which is good news. But, you know, the best news that I see is that in every community I go to, whether it's here in L.A., whether it's in New York, whether it's in our hometown in Detroit, we see organizations led by young people and with young people participating and young people on fire about this issue. I see it as the cause of the generation that's coming up right now. They say, you know, we may not be able to do much about health care and world peace right now and, you know, the politics that seem to be broken in this country, but by God, we can do something about the food system in our community, in our neighborhood, and more nationally. And they're doing it. They're picking up the charge and they're doing it.
And my sense is that whether it's ending a war or changing a food system, when you become active, you begin to look at things as systems. You begin to see your role in changing a system rather than just dealing with symptoms. You're empowered.
Right.
And then the other problems, it's like, so what's next?
Right. And I wrote my book for many kinds of folks, but I especially wrote my book for these young people who have a passion around this issue of food systems and food systems change, want to do something about it, and would like to know more and have a resource so they can get to other people and organizations. I wrote that book for you.
Okay. The book is Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. The websites are fairfoodnetwork.org and fairfoodbook.org. I'll be back in just a moment with Lila Connors, director of The 11th Hour, the climate change documentary with Leonardo DiCaprio, and producer of the film that we'll be talking about, Urban Roots. It's about the hopeful food and farming changes taking place in Detroit. Thank you, Orrin Hesterman. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. Pleasure to be with you.
Now we are going to talk about Urban Roots. Detroit native Mark McInnes directed this film, and it tells the powerful story of a group of dedicated Detroiters working to fulfill their vision for locally grown, sustainably farmed food in a city where people, as in much of the country, have found themselves cut off from real food, limited to the lifeless offerings of fast food chains and mini-marts and grocery stores stocked with processed food from thousands of miles away. It was produced by my next guest, Lila Connors. And Lila Connors is founder and president of Tree Media Group, and she's director, producer, and writer, as I said, of The 11th Hour, as well as some short films, Global Warning and Water Planet. She was associate editor at New Perspectives Quarterly and Global Viewpoint before moving into the moving media. And welcome to Free Forum, Lila Connors.
Thanks, Terrence. Happy to be here.
Very quickly, what is Tree Media?
Tree Media is a multimedia company in the truest sense of the word. We do film, we do websites, we do anything to tell a story about the future that we all want and around things like sustainability, human rights, and that.
Very good. And one thing that struck me was how this film, Urban Roots, is very different. I mean, from the same sensibility, but very different from your previous, The 11th Hour. Talk just a little bit about that.
Yes, 11th Hour was a big look at the nature of the problem and how we get out of it. And it was global in nature. And it had 72 experts, and it had every issue that we could possibly think of, air, water, soil. And then we drove into things like human nature and consumption, and then how do we fix it with a change of heart. And such a global topic really asked for, in my following projects, of which there are a few, Urban Roots was basically a story about a group of people in one city that learned how to survive post-industrially, in the post-industrial collapse. And what I mean by post-industrial collapse is when you live in a town where the jobs are gone, and they have been gone for many, many years, many decades in the case of Detroit, and nothing has come in to fill those jobs, no company has moved in, and all that they've been experiencing in Detroit was a continued loss of jobs, loss of livelihood, et cetera. We chose to focus on them because they found a way out of their predicament. And that, to me, was a jewel of a story and very localized, but yet applicable to everybody. And that's why I love this story.
Yeah. How did this film happen?
Well, Mark, who was from Detroit, was shooting the farms and came to us with the footage and said, hey, you know, let's make a movie. And I said, you know, this is a great movie for a lot of reasons, not just because the farms are interesting, but precisely because we live in a time when the economy is changing, when globalization has basically taken a hit, has basically hit our local communities, and the quality of life is declining in many places in our country. And so what has happened is local economies are growing in places where the global economy is left behind. So in the case of Detroit, the urban farms have created a local economy. That's the hope and the dream, and is actually happening, where in some cases small farms are supplying restaurants with food. There's mobile markets where people are, you know, growing food and then literally supplying the neighborhood with food by driving literally the food to people. Very different food system models than we have currently in big towns like LA, where we have big supermarkets, and now we have farmers markets, which is great, but there's a lot more that can be done to localize food, and that's what they're experimenting with in Detroit.
Well, I was going to ask, is Detroit that far? One thing that, let me just tell people, one of the things that was very obvious at the very top, they said Detroit is huge. You could fit Boston, San Francisco, and Manhattan within the city limits of Detroit, and that it's a city that had 2 million residents and now has less than 1 million residents.
Yeah, I think it's close to 700,000, in fact.
Wow.
The census came out, and it was funny, when we were doing the graphic, we stopped at 900. We said 900,000. We said we bet you we could go even lower than that, and it sadly was true. And yes, a lot of our towns in America grew it during the time of the car, and so they're very large, and it was possible to live an hour away from work. And so when populations start to decline and people move elsewhere to get jobs, you have gigantic areas where you have one house on a block. And in this case, in Detroit, they live in what we call a food desert, which means that you have to drive more than 20 minutes to get to a place where you can get fresh fruits and vegetables. And so we found out that in America, there's a lot of food deserts.
What I was going to say is that, so Detroit obviously has two things that make it prime for this. One is all that space. So there's land. And two, all that dead economy. So there's people in need. Is Detroit actually ahead of other cities, or was it just the one that came to you and the one you had the footage of?
Well, I think both. Basically, we did have footage of that, and we thought, you know, we don't need to make the case that this is happening in every community in America, because people know it's happening in every community in America. If you're living in LA, in certain parts of Los Angeles, people live in a food desert, and they are creating urban farms. Urban farming is catching on all over the world, and at the end of Urban Roots, we actually show urban farms all over the world.
That's right. That's a wonderful sequence.
It's a sweet, yeah.
Yeah.
It basically says, look, Detroit's a metaphor, and yes, they are ahead, if indeed they can continue to make this model happen. So what I mean by that is the local citizens are saying, hey, we'd like to create this local economy, and in some cases the city is not so sure that that's the kind of economy they want. So meaning that, what, you know, we have in our film the mayor saying, well, what happens if Walmart would like to move in? We'd like to take that land and give it to Walmart. Or what about a golf course? You know, so the thinking is not 100%. Everyone's not all on the same page. And so I see, as our country goes through this transition between, you know, old style industrial capitalism to new decentralized capitalism with local thriving economies, we're going to have a lot of discussions around what kind of laws to put in place to support these kinds of local activities versus large
companies. I mean, one thing, I think I'm right that in Detroit, the action is ahead of the regulations.
Yes, indeed, yes. And I think people, especially also with Occupy, as you see, a lot of people are feeling that they see the solution, but the powers that be don't. And so in the case of Detroit, that, you know, they are not allowed to have large greenhouses. And I think it was 10 by 10 is the limit. But you can't really, you know, grow if you're, a small 1-acre farm. You need a bigger greenhouse. And so some people are just going ahead and doing that, even though it's, quote unquote, against the law.
Well, but also I hear one person in the film say, you know, but it's about $5,000.
Exactly.
And so do I want to invest in this greenhouse when it might, you know, when they might come and clamp down on me
and
once I've got it done and I'll be out that money.
Exactly.
Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Lila Connors. She's director of The 11th Hour, the big climate change documentary with Leonardo DiCaprio. We're talking about a new film of which she's producer, Urban Roots, and it's about the hopeful food and farming changes taking place in Detroit, but it's kind of a bellwether for, you know, any city USA. And you can learn more about the film and about their work at urbanrootsamerica.com. That's one word, urbanrootsamerica.com, or at treemedia.com. Do talk just a little bit about, say, L.A. and New York as two examples that are not Detroit. How are they doing? What is happening here, for instance?
Well, L.A., actually, as many of you probably know, many of your listeners know, had one of the biggest urban farms in the country, which was destroyed. And actually, there is a vote in city council coming up this Tuesday for preserving 2 acres of that piece of land. It was bulldozed, but the new owners of that land don't want to
honor that.
They haven't developed it. It's in escrow, and there's 2 acres or 2.7 acres or so that's supposed to be dedicated to green space, and the new owners do not want to honor that. So just a little note, anyone call the city council, LA City Council, and please ask them to honor the agreement to keep 2 acres of that piece of land open, and to
beyond that, beyond that, in that situation, what's happening in the greater city?
Well, in the greater city, I'm not an expert on what exactly is happening, but all I do know is that people are catching the bug for urban farming and creating farms on their roofs, farms in their backyard. In my neighborhood, people a lot of people have chickens. In New York as well, in Brooklyn especially, there's a lot of urban farming going on, especially on roofs, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
And they're all supplying local co-ops, local restaurants with the food. So this is not, I think New York has over 900 urban farms. So, and this was like as of a few years ago. And so I'm sure that number is growing. And especially in Los Angeles, where we have a lot of open space. Recently, a man named Ron Finley, and I think a lot of people saw that in the LA Times, was growing food on the side of his house. And he was cited by the city because I think his corn was, you know, growing over 18 inches and they wanted to cut it down. He prevailed, but it was one of those things where he was fined and things like that. So we are running up against municipal codes that need to be changed to support the innovation that people have within themselves to make their lives better. So Ron, I think, is out of the woods. We connected with him recently. So it's interesting.
We've got about 2.5 minutes left. Tell an individual story, because let me just say a little bit about Urban Roots. It's a beautiful film to watch. You know, so many documentaries that I feature on this show often are a lot of talking heads because they're about ideas and issues. But because the ideas and issues here are local farming, it's people with their hands in the dirt. It's green. It's this wonderful vision that you don't think of when you think of Detroit. So it's visually beautiful and it's a very hopeful, very positive film. Tell a story or two briefly.
Sure. One of the people that was in our film who has a very positive outlook was named Douglas Bennett. I'd like to honor him today because he was recently, sadly, hit by a car in Detroit. But what was
and he passed away.
He passed. So Doug in our film, you'll see, is one of the kinds of people that you look to for inspiration. You know, obviously he was a union auto worker who was laid off, not fired, but laid off, and he would go in and work as hard as he could for the company that he had worked for, but who had laid him off. And he said, look, as long as I can help the company grow, I'll do it. But in the meantime, I have my garden. It gives me peace of mind. And, you know, he basically said, you might be dealt a bad deck of cards, but it's what you make out of it, what good you can bring out of it. So Doug had an incredible view of life, and that's something that I think we should all remember.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to ask, and I want to make sure I get it in, is how can people see this film? How can people get this film? This is not getting theatrical distribution.
No, we chose to test the waters of independent distribution, and it's really interesting. Right now, it's on DVD. We are doing screenings around the country and around the world. We will be doing theatrical probably around Earth Day of next year. We're building up to that. And if you want a screen, just go to our website and we can arrange it for you.
Okay, so thing like house parties and so on for
yeah.
people who want to get into this movement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the film is Urban Roots. The websites are Urban Roots America, one word, urbanrootsamerica.com, and treemedia.com is the production company. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcast articles and transcripts of interviews. To join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. That's terrencemcnally.net. Or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, and I also usually put in two or three articles in there to give you background on it, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at T.E. McNally, one word, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y, at mac.com. You can also go to iTunes to get the podcast or to sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. Thank you to our earlier guest, Orrin Hesterman. His book, again, is Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. His websites are fairfoodnetwork.org and fairfoodbook.org. Finally, thank you to Lila Connors. The film is Urban Roots. Go to urbanrootsamerica.com and you can find out how to get it and do screenings of it. Thank you and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Terrence.